This is Precepts Audio Message PA511. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
Psalm 81, the Psalm of Asaph. So this is the 10th of the 12 Asaph Psalms, and the 9th in the third book. And Seller says that the introduction to this psalm is the psalms that have come before. These are the Asaphic psalms. And if you don't recognize that, of course, a lot of the psalms are Davidic, but these psalms are not. They're written by Asaph or by the family of Asaph. Now, Rotherham notes throughout here the mention of the God of Jacob in verses 1 and 4. Israel in verses 4, 8, 11, and 13, Joseph in verse 5, and my people in verses 8, 11, and 13. And he believes that this points to the focus on the northern kingdom. In fact, he points out that the northern kingdom seems to be the focus in a lot of the Asaph Psalms. And he suggests that we remember that the Levites were spread out throughout the lands of the other tribes. Remember, Levi had no tribal territory. But they had cities throughout the other tribes. So there would have been Levites both in the north and in the south. Now this particular Asaph, or part of Asaph's house, is an interesting character. And it seems that his method is to take his harp and to go into the northern kingdom and to sing this psalm to the people to bring them the message of God. Rotherham says of it, "There needs but one touch further to make the picture live before us. And that is the conception of a missionary Levite traversing the north, harp in hand, and trying to win back the wanderers by singing to them this song. Other songs of the series there were which he may have sung at other times, or in alternation with this. His was a harp of many strings. At one time he would gently remind Ephraim how he had turned in the day of battle, and how Joseph had irrevocably lost the honor of having the sacred tent within his bounds, as we saw it in Psalm 78. At another time he would boldly claim for Judah the supreme honor of having that cherubic throne in his midst," in Psalm 80. Of course, that was his idea that it was by this same character at the same time. Bullinger thought it was earlier, and I tend to think that maybe Bullinger is right. Anyway, Rotherham goes on to say, "But even before he could win attention to those messages, here was one which would strike a winsome herald note. Impinging on no susceptibilities save of apostates wholly given to idolatry, containing no allusion to the South, no mention of David. Radical reform, it is true, would demand the declaration of fuller truth in these regards, but all cannot be done at once. It is worth an effort, costing self-restraint, to win the ear of the rebellious, even for a moment, provided some essential things can be successfully lodged therein. And truly the most essential thing of all, for Israelites wandering away into idolatry, is here. Their covenant relation to Jehovah, and his inexorable claim that their obligations under that covenant be fulfilled." So that was his comment on the psalm, and that would seem to fit the psalm, that it is an appeal to the northern kingdom to remember their God and to fulfill their covenant with him. So verse 1, "Sing aloud unto God our strength. Make a joyful noise unto the God of Jacob." Rotherham translates this, "Ring out your joy unto God our strength. Give a sacred shout to the God of Jacob." So this is calling on God's people to praise him, to make a ringing cry unto God our strength. And then to make a joyful noise. The word means to shout. And the shout could be for various reasons. In this case, it is a shout of praise. "Make a joyful noise unto the God of Jacob." This would be the God of Israel, but Israel under the Jacob character, the heel grabber. He says, verse 2, "Take a psalm and bring hither the timbrel, the pleasant harp with the psaltery." So how do you take a psalm? Well, it means take up. And our phrase would generally be raise a song. Raise a song, what kind of the idea of lifting up your voices in singing, or lift up the music. And bring hither the timbrel or the tambourine, and the pleasant harp with a psaltery. Psaltery there is literally a skin bottle, probably meaning some kind of hollow instrument. Bullinger suggests this means a lute. Then he says, blow up the trumpet in the new moon, in the time appointed on our solemn feast day. Blow up the trumpet. Well, that would mean to blast. Blast the trumpet is how we'd probably put it. The trumpet, well, don't think of that brass instrument that we have. It means a horn. And this was probably a ram's horn instrument, which was a common instrument that they had. So blow the horn or the ram's horn in the new moon. Now, what does this mean, the new moon? What's the significance of that? Well, remember, the new moon was always the first day of their months. For their months truly were moons. And they weren't just fictional divisions of the year like ours are. They actually were according to the phases of the moon. And the only remnant of that we have in English is the fact that we call them months, which is really moons shortened. But really they have nothing to do with the moon anymore. Well, since they were actually moons, their moons would start in the new moon. The middle of the month would be the full moon, and then the end of the month, of course, is when you get to the new moon again. So the new moon was the start of the month. And Numbers 28 and verses 11 through 14 shows us that the beginning of every month was celebrated in the God-given religion. It says in Numbers 28:11, and in the beginning of your months ye shall offer a burnt offering unto the Lord. 2 young bullocks and 1 ram, 7 lambs of the first year without spot. And going on through verse 14, which ends, this is the burnt offering of every month throughout the months of the year. So at the beginning of every month, they were supposed to give special sacrifices on the first day of the month. And so they celebrated the beginning of every month in the, like I said, the God-given religion. Now we realize that the trumpet, when you're talking about a trumpet blowing, that was especially blown on the first day of the seventh month, in what we'll often call the feast or the festival of trumpets. And we can see that in Leviticus 23 and verse 24, where it says, speak unto the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, in the first day of the month, shall ye have a Sabbath, a memorial of blowing of trumpets and holy convocation. So they would blow the trumpets on the first day of the seventh month. Now, from the Jews today, we would hear that the fact is that the religious calendar, which is what the Bible always goes off of, when God introduced the Passover and said that the month of the Passover, he says, this will be this month will be the beginning of the year for you. And the Jews say that that was because that wasn't the beginning of the year before then. He changed that to be the beginning of the year. But before then, the beginning of the year was actually what on God's calendar is the seventh month. And so the first day of the seventh month was actually their New Year's Day. And they still celebrate the first day of the seventh month as the New Year. They call it Rosh Hashanah, or the head of the year, meaning the source of the year, the outflowing source of the year, or the head, the New Year. Now, they still call it that. Obviously, they refused to ever completely change over to making what the Lord said was the first month in their estimation. They kept the first day of the seventh month. And the Jews believe that creation actually began on the first day of the seventh month. That was the first day of creation, which is possible. Now, besides being blown on the Feast of Trumpets, the trumpet was also blown on the 10th day of the seventh month, which was the Day of Atonement, on the year before the Jubilee. We read about that in Leviticus 25, verse 9. Where in verse 8 it says, thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years, or 49 years. And the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Notice he emphasizes that 49 years. It'll be 49 years, which is why I think the Jubilee year was an interruption. It wasn't the first year of the next 49. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the day of atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And ye shall hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants of thereof. It shall be a Jubilee unto you. And ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. So to announce the upcoming Jubilee year, the trumpet was blown on the Day of Atonement, on the 49th year, the year before the Jubilee. So, of course, that was not on the new moon, though. That was on the 10th of the month. So this is probably a reference to the Feast of Trumpets. Blow up the trumpet in the new moon. And then he says, in the time appointed on our solemn feast day. But the word for time appointed there actually seems to be the word for in the full moon. Now, when would they blow a trumpet in the full moon? Well, remember that Passover was on the 15th of the month. And if the first day of the month is always the new moon, what's the 15th of the month going to be? Well, that's going to be the full moon, of course. So the Passover was actually on the full moon. So on our, he says, on our solemn feast day. And again, the Jewish feasts, of course, these were their festivals, and they weren't just days for eating. And if you look at the Passover meal, it wasn't much of a feast. It was a pretty lousy meal, actually, if you were actually just trying to get an enjoyable meal. Today, when they do their Seder feast, they add a whole lot of delicious things to it, which had nothing to do with Passover, which was just lamb, hard unleavened bread, and you served it with bitter herbs, which, of course, would make the whole thing not taste very good. Or else you'd some people think it was a bitter cup that you dip your lamb and your bread in, which would make, again, make them taste bitter. So one of the feasts, quote-unquote, was actually the fast, the Day of Atonement, which shows that it doesn't actually mean a feast. According to our idea, it was a festival. So blow the trumpet in the new moon and the full moon on our solemn festival day. Verse 4, for this was a statute for Israel and a law of the God of Jacob. So this was a statute and a law that God appointed, this blowing of the trumpet and the new moon. Now Rotherham points out that the festival of trumpets, since it had nothing to do with the temple or the priesthood, but it was done city by city throughout the land, and also, especially when you consider that it was connected with their New Year celebration, it might well have continued in the northern kingdom when all the other rituals had been neglected. You know, they might have given up on Passover and all the other festivals, but they could have continued the Feast of Trumpets, and probably did. So if he's appealing to the northern kingdom, he might be appealing to celebrate the one celebration of the Lord you actually still keep, but remember, it's supposed to be celebrating the Lord. So Asaph is calling on the northern kingdom here to make their yearly celebration to the God of Jacob, not just to the foreign gods that they typically rebelliously worshipped. Verse 5, this he ordained in Joseph for a testimony when he went out through the land of Egypt. So he ordained this in Joseph for a testimony. And again, Joseph could be put for the entire nation. Although from the days of Joshua on, and Joshua was of Joseph, he was of the tribe of Ephraim. The tribes of Joseph, and especially Ephraim, were the leading tribes in the northern kingdom, just like Judah was the leading tribe in the south. So he says, he ordained this in Joseph for a testimony. Now this word testimony is an interesting one, and it's a name that sometimes is applied to the Ark of the Testimony. Now why is that? Well, it comes from the fact that the testimony was stored in the ark. We can see this in Exodus chapter 25 and verse 21. When he says, and thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark, that was the cover, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee. So he says, there's a cover on the ark, and inside the ark is the testimony I'm going to give you. Well, what was the testimony that he gave him to put in the ark? Well, we turn to Exodus 32 and we find out that it was the two stone tables written with the finger of God. Exodus 32, verse 15. It says, and Moses turned and went down from the mount, and the two tables of the testimony were in his hand. The tables were written on both their sides, on the one side and on the other were they written, and the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, graven upon the tables. Well, the tables are supposed to go on the ark, but they didn't. They were broken at the foot of the mount when Moses saw the terrible provocation of the golden calf, verse 19. And it came to pass, as soon as he came nigh unto the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hand and brake them beneath the mount. However, these tables were replaced. And although God gave Moses the tables, this time Moses was the one who wrote on the tables, not God. Exodus 34, verses 28 through 29 says of Moses, and he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. Now, this was after the golden calf. He'd been 40 days and 40 nights before the golden calf. After the golden calf, he went up the mountain and was there 40 days and 40 nights again. He did neither eat bread nor drink water, and he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And it came to pass when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tables of testimony in Moses' hand, when he came down from the mount, that Moses wist not that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. So Moses came down the mount with these tables of the testimony. Well, now, since the tabernacle contained the ark, which contained the testimony, the tabernacle could sometimes be called the tabernacle of the testimony. Exodus 38 and verse 21 says, this is the sum of the tabernacle, even of the tabernacle of the testimony, as it was counted according to the commandment of Moses for the service of the Levites by the hand of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. Now we actually have, per God's commandment, the testimony being put into the ark in Exodus 40, verses 20 through 21. And he took and put the testimony into the ark. And of course, this was the second testimony, the second two tables, not the first. And set the staves on the ark, and put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and he brought the ark into the tabernacle, and set up the veil of the covering, and covered the ark of the testimony, as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, the one other thing that was named after the testimony was the veil that was in the temple and that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies, which, since it was veiling the place where the testimony was, is called the veil of the testimony in Leviticus 24 and verse 3. Without the veil of the testimony in the tabernacle of the congregation. So very interesting that the testimony was actually these tables with the Ten Commandments written on them. Now, the idea of the word testimony is of a precept, a law, a revelation, or a witness. So what he's speaking of here, of course, is not of the tables of the testimony, but of the fact of these blowing of these trumpets, which the blowing of the trumpets was to be a testimony in Joseph. This he ordained to Joseph for a testimony when he went out through the land of Egypt. Or Bullinger says this means in the sight of Egypt. So this takes them back to the earliest history of their nation and the great things God did for them then when he brought them out of Egypt and then gave them all his laws and his festivals. Then it says, where I heard a language that I understood not. Now here we have someone speaking personally, and it seems to be Israel speaking, though the speaker changes to God in the next verse. So we have one line from Israel, it seems. Now, where I heard a language I understood not, what does this mean? Because, of course, Israel had lived in Egypt for generations, and so, of course, they understood Egyptian. Well, in this regard, Rotherham quotes Driver as saying, the psalmist, speaking in the name of the nation, says that at the Exodus, Israel first learned to know the voice of its deliverer. So he thinks that it means that it was the speech of God, not a new language that they didn't know before. Now, the word in Hebrew for language literally means lip. And, of course, while one of the things you use to speak a language is your lip, so the lip could be used for the language, here it seems to mean a new voice speaking, not a new language speaking. That is, for the first time they heard the voice of their true God that Israel and Egypt had not known before. They had all but forgotten about him there in the land of Egypt, where they learned to worship the gods of Egypt, and then their God came to them and spoke to them, and they heard a new voice, which at first they didn't understand. They hadn't heard the voice of God before. Now, Rotherham ends the first stanza here as we move from the call to the people to worship the Lord and to celebrate God and to remember his work with them in history. In the second stanza, we have God himself speaking and reminding them of the deeds he worked in the past on their behalf and using those as the basis for his claim on them as a nation and the basis for his covenant he entered into with them. So we see that in verse 6 and on through the second stanza. So verse 6, I removed his shoulder from the burden, his hands were delivered from the pots. So this is still speaking of Egypt, when they were leaving Egypt and leaving slavery. So I removed his shoulder from the burden. And of course they were subjected to hard manual labor in Egypt. And so the Lord, when he rescued them from that, rescued them from the burden of this manual labor. Then his hands were delivered from the pots. But Bullinger makes it baskets. And he says that these are depicted in Egyptian paintings as being used in brick making. So, of course, as we know from the record in Exodus, the Israelites were involved in the making of bricks for the building of many of Egypt's building projects. So they were, their hands were delivered from the baskets, the brick making baskets, when he rescued them from slavery in Egypt. Then verse 7, thou callest in trouble, and I delivered thee. I answered thee in the secret place of thunder. I proved thee at the waters of Meribah, Selah. So thou callest in trouble, and I delivered thee. And he did this. They had cried out to God in their distress, in their trouble, in their slavery in Egypt. And he had delivered them. He brought them out of it. Then I answered thee in the secret place of thunder, in the covering of thunder. And this would appear to refer to the pillar of cloud in which God had dwelt among his people while he was guiding them out of Egypt and through the wilderness. And yet at the same time, that cloud hid his presence among them. Now clouds, of course, are the origin of thunder. And so the covering of thunder is the cloud. And he answered them from this. And you have to wonder, when he spoke from that cloud, was his voice like thunder? Is that one reason for the statement here? Then he says, I proved thee at the waters of Meribah. Proved there means tested or tried. The waters of Meribah are the waters of strife or the waters of contention. And if we would look at Exodus chapter 17, we'd see this. Exodus chapter 17, in verse 1, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys according to the commandment of the Lord and pitched in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, why chide ye with me? Wherefore do ye tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses, and said, wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said unto Moses, go on before the people, and take with thee of the elders of Israel, and thy rod, wherewith thou smotest the river, take in thine hand, and go. Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the chiding of the sons of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? So they called this place Massah and Meribah. Massah meaning testing, and Meribah meaning strife or contention. And, of course, in Exodus, that was the place where the people contended against God for really the first time. Now, they had murmured against him earlier in chapter 16, but here they really strove with him. They fought with him because of not having water. Now, God answered by having Moses strike the rock, and water gushed out. Now, they might have thought of it as testing God. Will God provide water for us or not? But this verse tells us that God considered this truly as a test of the people, that they were being tested to see if they would have faith in God to provide for them. And of course, they failed the test. They murmured and they fought against him when they found they didn't have enough water to drink. So they were tested and came up short at the waters of Meribah. Then he says, Selah. And this is, as we've talked about, the great connecting word. And Bullinger says that this connects the merciful deliverance that we have in verse 7 with the reason why Israel should listen in verse 8. Where he says, Hear, O my people, and I will testify unto thee. O Israel, if thou wilt hearken unto me. So this is the call to the people of Israel, who up to now had not been hearing and had not been hearkening. And here really we have the purpose of the psalm, is to call them to listen and to respond properly to what they hear. So they are to hear, they are to listen, his people, and he is going to testify unto them. He's going to bear witness unto them. And he says, If they will hearken unto me, verse 9, there shall no strange god be in thee, neither shalt thou worship any strange god. And strange god refers to a foreign god. Now, the thought that was generally in the minds of the nations at that time was that they each had their national gods, their gods who supported them. I've read some historians who believe that this may have grown out of ancestor worship. Mankind has always had a problem with really believing God when he says that dying you will die, and that the dead are really dead and no longer in any kind of existence at all. And so they would worship their dead ancestors and pray to them and ask them to watch out for them. And the thought would be that your dead ancestors might favor you and help you in difficulty. Well, this was very personal family worship, of course, but it then could grow into the gods of nations as you had large and powerful households. This historian thought, anyway, is you had large and powerful households that worshiped their gods, then those gods, because of their influence in the cities, might have grown to be worshiped by the whole city, and eventually they grew into gods of the nations. Well, your God supposedly favored your nations, whereas the gods of other nations favored those nations. And it didn't enter their thinking that you're out to look for the best God, or you're out to look for the real God, or the strongest or most powerful God. No, you worshipped your God because he was your God. It didn't matter if he was the top one or the best one or not. He was yours. And I've compared it to our sports teams. You know, you go to the sports game and you cheer, we're number one. And if your team loses and you find out you're not number one, you don't go, oh man, I was wrong. Well, time to start rooting for that team now. Well, no, you just keep rooting for your team. It doesn't matter if they lose. And it was the same way with their gods. They were out for their God because he was on their side. Now, into this background, the true God entered, and he made Israel his nation, and denied that Israel had any other God but himself. Now, throughout this time, he didn't just let Israel think that he was a God like the gods of all the other nations. He made it clear to them that he was, in fact, the true God of all. And, as we know, later in New Testament times, he sent salvation out to all nations equally, so that all could come to him, the true God. Now, in a way, God chose Israel and identified himself with them as his nation, in the style of the nations who looked at gods as naturally theirs. And so God said, okay, I will take a nation as my nation, and I'll reveal myself through that nation to all the other nations. Now, in a way, that was intended to, as I said, show up and debunk the idea of gods of nations. And yet, at the same time, this didn't mean that he didn't really mean it or was just playing pretend when he said that he was Israel's God. When he took Israel as his special people, he truly did so. He really was their God and was the God of Israel over all other nations on earth. Even today, there's no nation on earth that can say that God has been or ever will be especially theirs except Israel. So if there is any nation that is particularly God's nation over every other, it's Israel. So Israel was to have no foreign gods. And this points to two things. Number one, if they would listen to God, they would stop this practice of turning their back on him and worshiping the gods of the nations around them instead. And this was the thing, is that the nations generally were faithful to their gods. Like I said, they were theirs. They didn't give them up and start worshiping the gods of other nations. They clung to them. And yet Israel was constantly letting go of the true God and embracing the false gods of the nations around them and forgetting the God who had taken them as his own and made them his nation. And so the Lord complained to them, what nation has given up their gods like you've given up me? And no other nation had. So they were to stop doing that, to get rid of the strange and foreign gods from among them and serve him. They would have done that if they truly listened to him. But also, of course, these foreign gods were represented by the foreigners themselves. And when Israel was unfaithful to God, he allowed them to be conquered and enslaved by the nations around them. So then these foreign gods would be among Israel due to the fact that they had been brought into Israel by these foreign invaders and these foreign conquerors. Well, if Israel would stop being unfaithful and would listen to God, then all these strangers with their strange gods would be cast out of Israel and would have no access, would not be able to conquer it and be among them. So there shall be no strange gods in thee, neither shalt thou worship any foreign god. Now God here is El. The typical name for God in the Old Testament is Elohim, which is plural but uses singular verbs, which usually plural noun goes with a plural verb. Here we have this false god, it's spoken of as El, the singular, and the verb is also singular. Of course, this is speaking of these false gods. Shall have no strange El in thee, neither shalt thou worship, and that means to bow down or prostrate yourself, sometimes in worship. Shall not worship any foreign god. Now this is a different word, again meaning foreign but emphasizing an alien as opposed to a stranger. The first word means a foreigner isn't a stranger. This one means an alien foreigner. Verse 10, I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Open thy mouth wide, and I will fill it. So here Jehovah names himself as their true national God. For the first time in this psalm, of course, previously he has spoken of himself as God, the God of Jacob, and so forth. But here he identifies his name, Jehovah. That he, Jehovah, is their God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Jehovah is the one who brought them out of Egypt. He is the one who rescued them from slavery and made them a nation in the first place. Then he says, open thy mouth wide, and I will fill it. Sellers thinks this means to fill it with praise. Rotherham quotes Delitzsch, a believing yearning which is hungering for grace and eager for salvation. So he wants them to open their mouths wide, and he would fill them. So Rotherham ends the second stanza here with the end of Jehovah's appeal to his nation. And then the third and final stanza contains his personal lament over the failures of his people, along with promises of future glory and blessing, if they will return. Now, these promises, of course, ultimately will find their final and full fulfillment in the kingdom of God. So verse 11, "But my people would not hearken to my voice, and Israel would none of me." So they stubbornly refused to hear his call, as he had given it in verse 8. They wouldn't listen. "And Israel would none of me," or that means wanted no part of me, or consented not to me. So they wouldn't submit themselves to yield to him and follow him as they ought to have done. Verse 12, "So I gave them up unto their own heart's lust, and they walked in their own counsels." So he gave them up, and this is one of the most terrible things God can do to men, to give them up to their own corrupt hearts. As long as God continues to graciously seek and call, there's hope. But when he gives up, things are black indeed. So he gave them up to their own heart's lust, their own heart's strong desires. And they walked in their own counsels. So he left them free to do so. He didn't no longer tried to pressure them and speak to them and call them back to himself. He just let them go in their own counsels. Verse 13, "Oh, that my people had hearkened unto me, and Israel had walked in my ways." And of course, by "oh" there he means "if only." That's how we would put it in English. "If only my people had hearkened to me." And of course, this would have been the response he would have preferred to his call of verse 8. Rather than refusal to hear, he would prefer that they had hearkened to him. And that Israel would have walked in my ways, instead of course, in their own counsels, as they did in verse 12. "Now if they had done so," he says, verse 14, "I should soon have subdued their enemies and turned my hand against their adversaries." And this is what he would have done if they only had listened to him, is that he would have subdued their enemies. And what happened to Israel over and over again when they would not listen to God, so he'd lead them to their own ways, is that they would be conquered and oppressed by their powerful enemies. Now he was always able to subdue these before them easily, if only they had listened to him. But they did not. And when they did listen to him and turn to him, well, he would subdue their enemies and turn his power against their adversaries. Verse 15, "The haters of the Lord should have submitted themselves unto him, but their time should have endured forever." So the haters of the Lord should have submitted themselves unto him, and the idea is that they would have come cringing to him. And there has been an unfortunate trend in some modern translators of making this, "should have pretended obedience to him," which is, I think, a highly suspect translation and not much to God's glory, as if the Lord would have been fooled by pretended obedience. But the idea is that they come cringing before him because they realize that they have no choice but to do so because of his mighty power. Now, the idea would certainly seem to be that if it weren't for his mighty power, they wouldn't have come cringing before him. But that doesn't mean that they are only pretending to obey him. They're obeying him because they have no choice. Now, but their time should have endured forever. Now, there was no reason for Israel to be destroyed and to cease being a nation before God's kingdom outflow. If they had been faithful and listened to God and obeyed him consistently, well, they never would have lost their status as a nation. And they would still exist as a nation today. Not as a nation, mind you, restored by the United Nations from some people who are thought to be Israelites, but nobody knows for sure. But they would exist as a nation that had never ceased to exist in the first place. It was not necessary for the destruction and the scattering that happened to them to have happened if they would have listened to the Lord. They could have still continued to this day. And so if they had listened to the Lord all along, their time would have endured for the outflow. That's the Hebrew olam. Perpetually. So they would have stayed as a nation until the kingdom started, and then, of course, they would have stayed as a nation through the kingdom and the great outflow of God to come, and through the parousia, they never would have stopped being a nation. They never would have been scattered as they were. But, of course, we know that that's not what they did. And the Lord knew all along that that would not be what they would do. But if they had done that, well, their nation would have continued, and it would still be there. There would have been no break. Verse 16, he should have fed them also with the finest of the wheat, and with honey out of the rock should I have satisfied thee. So he should have fed, this seems to rather, it should be that I should have fed them also with the finest of the wheat. And in Hebrew, that's literally with the fat of the wheat, which would be their figure for the choicest portion of the wheat, the very best wheat, the very finest wheat. And then with honey out of the rock should I have satisfied thee. And of course we recognize in the story of Jonathan running through the wood, the honey dripping out of the trees. Well, honey out of a tree is one thing. Honey out of a rock, goodness. But nothing would be too good for Israel if they had only listened to and faithfully served their God. He loves to provide his abundance for his people if only they will serve and obey him. And yet we know that Israel did not do that. Now Israel will, in fact, never return to God until God acts on them to bring them back to himself. And so this is what he will do at the advent of the kingdom of God. So this is the true message of the psalm, is that God desires to bless his people if only they would come back to him. And yet the true message, of course, is that these glorious things will happen to Israel in the kingdom of God. So the message of the psalm to be learned by its audience is that they should listen to their God, and that then he will bless them. And we know that that is what will happen someday. Now there is no postscript to this psalm, just a short prelude to the next psalm. So the psalm stops there, leaving us on that high note of what could have happened to Israel, what would have happened to Israel, if only they had listened to God and served him. That they would have continued to this day and been the greatest and finest and most blessed of nations. Psalm 82. Here we have another psalm of Asaph. And this is the 11th of the 12 Asaph psalms and the 10th in this third book of psalms, the Leviticus book. In this psalm, we have an interesting picture. God is pictured as having arrived at a meeting of Israel's assembly or congress. And he is preparing to speak to them at a time when they have become sadly corrupt. Asaph, as if an observer to this event, presents the picture to us, both for our instruction and for the warning of the corrupt assembly thus addressed. This psalm serves a very important and practical purpose of teaching the divine authority and the heavy responsibility of those who served in Israel as judges among men. Now what is spoken here to judges, these judges are designated by one of the names of deity, Elohim. And this is not unusual, for this is in harmony with the use of the word Elohim in the book of Exodus. And this is done for the purpose of teaching, so that they will know that it is from God that their authority is derived, that it is his justice they've been called to maintain, and that the wrongs of men in being referred to them to be righted are supposed to be referred for divine adjudication. All of these disputes between men had to be settled with inflexible impartiality. At the same time, these judges are hereby reminded that they are also under law and very liable to be called into account for the manner in which they discharge the duties of their high office. The supreme judge appears in the midst of these smaller judges and arraigns them at his bar. Though this psalm relates to Israel's assembly particularly, we can still apply much of what God says here to the corrupt assemblies of nations, even in our day. What would God's word to any civil leader in our day be? Well, it would be to call on them to rule like he says here. And yet, for the most part, they do not. So verse 1, God standeth in the congregation of the mighty, he judgeth among the gods. So here it says, Elohim standeth in the congregation of the mighty, Elohim the true God. Now imagine what a stir it would cause in our own U.S. Congress if God showed up to address them. That's something to think about. Well, here, of course, he's addressing the Congress of Israel. He standeth, or he takes his stand, he stations himself to address them, in other words. Now, the congregation of the mighty in Hebrew, that's actually the congregation of God. In this case, the Hebrew El. Elohim standeth in the congregation of El. So he is standing in God's assembly. Then he judgeth among the gods. Or in the midst of the gods, he judges. Now, why are Israel's representative assembly members called gods? Well, God's rulers and representatives are called little g gods in harmony with the book of Exodus. If we turn to Exodus chapter 21 and verse 6. Exodus 21 and verse 6, where our King James Version reads, Then his master shall bring him unto the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Now our King James translators have translated it judges here, but in the Hebrew this is the word Elohim. His master shall bring him to the gods. And by gods here, that means, as our translators have interpreted it, not translated it, but interpreted it, that means the judges. But Exodus calls them the gods. The master brings his servant to the gods. Now Exodus 22 and verse 8. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand onto his neighbor's goods. So this would be in verse 7, a man delivers to his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it's stolen out of the neighbor's house. If the thief is found, he has to pay double, but if the thief isn't found, then the master of the house is brought to the gods to see whether he stole his neighbor's goods that he was supposed to be watching out for. So this man is brought to the gods, the Elohim, which our translators have interpreted as meaning the judges. Then verse 9, for all manner of trespass, whether it be for an ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges. And whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. But again, it's not judges, it's Elohim, the gods. Then verse 28 of the same chapter. Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people. Now here at least our King James translators have left it as the gods, which they could have done in the other passages but didn't. So this, of course, is not talking about reviling the false gods of the nations around Israel. You could always revile them. But this is talking about Israel's judges, which are called the gods. You aren't to revile Israel's judges. You aren't to revile the gods. And, of course, Paul quotes this in speaking to the high priest in Acts 23 and verse 8. You shall not revile the ruler of your people. Of course, but in Exodus it actually says you shall not revile the gods. Now, this is consistent with what God said to Moses in Exodus chapter 7 and verse 1. When the Lord said to Moses, See, I have made thee a god to Pharaoh. And Aaron thy brother shall be thy prophet. So I have made you one of the Elohim to Pharaoh. So throughout the book of Exodus, in multiple times, Israel's leaders, their judges, are called gods. Now we are actually in the Leviticus book of Psalms, not the Exodus book. But this psalmist, Asaph, uses the terminology from the book of Exodus, which would have been very familiar to the Jews, not so familiar to us since our translators have wave the magic wand of a translation to make it go away. But God here is judging among the judges, which are called here the gods. Verse 2. How long will you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Selah. So Elohim himself now speaks to these little g gods, little e Elohim. And he asks them, how long will you judge unjustly? How long will you set things in order in an unrighteous and unjust way? In other words, how long will you accept the persons of the wicked? And in Hebrew, this is literally, take up the faces of the wicked. In other words, take up their cause, or take their sides in court. Now, why would they sided with the wicked? Well, no doubt because of bribes tendered. So with their pockets full of bribes, they favor the wicked in their courtrooms. And God asks, how long are you going to do this? Now this verse ends, Selah, which is again is that connecting word, joining what they were actually doing, accepting the faces of the wicked because of the bribes, with what they ought to have been doing, which was doing real justice. Selah is often also a call to ponder. As if God is saying, think about what I just said, and then think about it further in the light of this that I say next. So, it calls upon us not just to connect these two things, but also to think deeply about both of them. And that's what these gods ought to do. So he says, verse 3, defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. So he says, defend, literally though that's judge, meaning of course judge justly. Judge properly the poor and fatherless, meaning the weak or defenseless are the poor. And of course, these would be ones who would be unable to afford a bribe. So if justice is going to be done for them, it's going to have to be done by a righteous judge, not by one who's looking forever can give him the biggest bribe. Now the poor are the weak or defenseless, and the fatherless is equivalent to the protectorless. Because understand, a father was a child's true protection in those days. A mother could provide no real protection. She would need it herself. Everyone had to be under a patriarch to have protection. So the fatherless were the protectorless. Now even today, children without fathers in the home are most likely to be targeted by sexual predators. They aren't looking for intact families. They're looking for children with mothers and no fathers. So even today, the fatherless often lack protection. Then he says, do justice to the afflicted and needy. And these would be the wretched and in want. He says, do justice for them. Of course, these, again, can't pay bribes, but they need justice. And they need justice far more than those who can pay bribes. So he says, give these justice. Then verse 4, deliver the poor and needy, rid them out of the hand of the wicked. And deliver there could mean save. Save the poor and needy. The first word is the same word in verse 3, the weak, the defenseless. The second word is a new word meaning the oppressed. Deliver the weak and oppressed. And then rid them out of the hand of the wicked. That means to rescue them, to snatch them away from danger. So here we have the four commands of God to these gods. Judge, do justice, save, and rescue. Now, of course, the hand of the wicked is put for the power of the wicked. And this is what rulers are always supposed to do, is to deliver people out of the power of criminals. And yet, many criminal rulers refuse to do that, which is their great duty. Now, verse 5, they know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. Now, when I've taught this psalm in the past, I've assumed that God's statement ends at the end of verse 4, and that verse 5 is the psalmist Asaph's indignant assessment of the response of the assembly, that they refuse to know or understand the words just addressed to them. And so Rotherham shakes his head at their blind rejection of what God tells them they ought to do. But Rotherham makes a very good case that verse 5 actually continues God's address, and that God is here describing with compassion the poor and needy and defenseless person that he had described in verses 3 and 4 after injustice has been decided against him. And he is leaving the court in dejection and confusion, not knowing or understanding the twisting of justice that has just been perpetrated against him, and having no idea of the bribes that have passed from wicked hands to the hands of the gods to bring about his ruin. So they know not, neither will, and that means can, not will, neither can they understand. They don't know, they have no ability to understand what just happened. Then they walk on in darkness. And that is used sometimes figuratively for misery, which would add credence to Rotherham's interpretation. Then all the foundations of the earth are out of course. Now the foundations of the earth, and I think this should be the foundations of the land. The Hebrew word eretz can mean earth or land. And the gods he's speaking to are the rulers of the land of Israel. Now these Elohim are supposed to be the rulers who uphold the rule of law and bring about justice in the land. And they are supposed to be the pillars upholding God's law and justice. Yet these pillars of the land have all come out of their sockets. And the land teeters because of it, though these corrupt judges refuse to see it. Now it says out of course, and certainly the land whose rulers are unjust is off course. But the idea of this word is that the foundations teeter. The whole land teeters because the foundations are out of joint, out of socket. Verse 6, I have said, ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High. And so here God speaks again, if indeed he ever paused. Like I said, verse 5, Rotherham makes an argument that verse 5 is God continuing his speech. So now he speaks in indignation to these corrupt rulers who refuse to hear his appeal. I have said, ye are gods. Now again, this is a reference to the fact that he had formerly called them this in the book of Exodus. So he has named these judges as gods, all the way back in his law. Thus he exalted them and gave them the highest and most crucial responsibility, which is to represent him. Now the Lord uses this statement in his argument against the religious leaders in John 10:34-35, where they're wanting to put him to death for saying that he is the Son of God. And when he asked them, John 10:32, many good works have I showed you from my Father, for which of these works do you stone me? The Jews answered him, for a good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, and because that thou, being a man, makest thyself God. Jesus answered them, is it not written in your law, I said, ye are gods? If he called them gods, unto whom the word of God came, and the scripture cannot be broken, say ye of him whom the Father has sanctified and sent into the world, thou blasphemest, because I said, I am the Son of God? Well, if human judges who had been set up to rule under God's law could be called little g gods, how much more could Christ, the one sent by God into the world to represent him, be called the Son of God? So that was Christ's argument. But he got that right here from Psalm 82. I have said, you are gods. And all of you are children of the Most High. But the word there is not children. The Hebrew word is ben, or benim, meaning sons, or representatives. Remember, a son was the one who stood in the place and represented the Father. So what he's saying of these judges of Israel is that all of you are stand-ins for the Most High. And that's what they were. What a high responsibility was theirs. That they actually stood in the place of God before the people and stood in for him in bringing about his justice. Now, even those who do not rule in Israel under God's own laws, but who rule in other nations, should take it that their solemn responsibility is to rule over the men God made in his place. And thus they should do it his way, the way that God would have them to do it, the way of true justice. And yet, certainly, in a very special way, all the judges in Israel, all the gods in Israel, were sons, representatives, stand-ins for the Most High. Most High there is Elyon, which means the lofty or supreme God. So I have said to your gods, all of you are sons of the Most High, but ye shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. So though the Lord had made them gods, yet they would die like Adam. Meaning, of course, a member of Adam's race. So you might be little g gods, but you'll die like every other mortal man from Adam's family line has always done. So you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. And of course, that's what all the princes before them had done. And you shall be no different. Though in your arrogance you think your power is unending, you're going to die just like all the princes before you. You're going to fall just like all the princes before you. Verse 8, arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations. Now arise, as he's spoken of before, means to go into action. So he says, go into action, O God. Now God's statement ended at the end of verse 7, and we might imagine at this point Asaph and any faithful among the rulers in Israel meeting God, if we picture this as a literal meeting of Israel's assembly, meeting God as the assembly breaks up. And as God is leaving the assembly, they meet him on the way out and plead with him to delay no longer, but to bring in his kingdom, which of course is the only lasting solution for corrupt government. So they call him to go into action and to judge the earth. And to judge is a more all-encompassing word than the word govern or the word kingdom. It encompasses the whole of God's rule. And God setting the entire earth and all facets of it in his order. Now he shall judge the earth when he goes into action. But God is not judging the earth today, as we can see from the fact that the earth is not at all set up as God would, how God would have it set up today. Now the earth could also be the land from the perspective of Israel. Of course, from Israel's perspective, God's judging shall be the salvation of the land. Now, from our perspective, God's judging of the whole earth will save us all. And of course, we understand both of these are going to happen in his kingdom. So he calls on God to go into action and to judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations. And of course, inherit means that they shall be your portion. They shall be given to you. All nations shall be given to you as your portion. And indeed, God shall yet make all nations his portion. The first statement should probably be land, and yet here there is no doubt but that the scope is universal, as his kingdom will be universal, and all nations will be his portion. So the kingdom is not just Israel's kingdom, quote-unquote, as many people call it, but it's God's kingdom over the whole world. Now thus the psalm ends here as a solemn testimony against all corrupt rulers. And as I said, although this was written initially to Israel's corrupt rulers, the little g gods ruling under God, its message, it can be a solemn testimony to all corrupt rulers who should know that the God who loves justice and who cares about the poor and needy and defenseless, that he takes a dim view to the taking of bribes and the perversion of justice and the favoring of the wicked. And yet the psalm ends with a hopeful note that though rulers may refuse to listen and may continue unendingly in their corruption, yet there is an ultimate solution when God steps in and makes all the governments of this world his own. And when God's kingdom comes, then no such rulers as these will exist. Now again, there is no postscript to this psalm, and it proceeds right on to the final Asaph psalm next in Psalm 83. But that is all we have time for today, and so we will continue, look at the final Asaph psalm in our next study.